Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we talk about a difficult and deadly illness, eating disorders. An estimated 30 million Americans will struggle with an eating disorder in their lifetime, and a greater number of them are beginning on college campuses, unfortunately. We'll talk about it today with Dr. Jody Langford. She joins us from our Milwaukee studios. She's a board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist, medical director of the Child and Adolescent Eating Disorder Inpatient Program at Rogers Memorial Hospital, Oconomowoc. You can join in the conversation. Maybe you have a loved one who has struggled with an eating disorder. Maybe you have. How did you realize you needed help? And maybe you can talk a little about your treatment as well. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Dr. Jody Langford, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So millions of Americans struggle with one eating disorder or another. Can you give us an overview of the different types of eating disorders?
Sure. There's four main types of eating disorders. Anorexia nervosa is characterized by severe calorie restriction leading to a very low body weight. This is accompanied by intense fears of gaining weight and a disturbance in how one perceives their body. Bulimia nervosa is characterized by recurrent episodes of binge eating, and the binges are followed by inappropriate compensatory behaviors to prevent weight gain, such as self-induced vomiting, misuse of laxatives or diuretics. To meet criteria for bulimia, one needs to engage in the behaviors for once a week for 3 months. Binge eating disorder is a newer diagnosis in DSM-5, and that also contains recurrent episodes of binge eating, but unlike with bulimia, the binges are not followed by any compensatory behaviors. Avoidant restrictive food intake disorder is also a new eating disorder in DSM-5. It's called ARFUD for short. In this eating disorder, individuals fail to meet their nutritional needs, often due to a lack of interest in eating or avoiding eating due to feared outcomes. This is differentiated from anorexia in that there's not any disturbance in how they perceive their body.
So on the binge eating disorder, so they will binge and then just not eat for a long time?
To meet criteria for binge eating disorder, they need to engage in discrete episodes of binge eating. So it actually does not need to be followed by a fast or anything like that. Binges are characterized by eating more rapidly, eating large amounts of food, really feeling a sense of like you're not in control of the eating when it's happening. But it's not necessarily followed by skipping meals or fasting. We see that more commonly in bulimia.
In bulimia, okay. Well, I had a family member many years ago suffer from anorexia, so I have some background on it. It was a long time ago, but those are the kinds of things you just don't forget about. This happened to be a woman, but I understand that men struggle with eating disorders as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And the impact on their health is just now coming to our attention, apparently. What do we know about men versus women eating disorders?
Well, really, we know that males develop eating disorders. They develop all of the same eating disorders that females do. Recent estimates are that males develop eating disorders at a ratio of about 1 to 10 male to female, but many experts believe they're probably even more common among men than we had appreciated, just because awareness is improved for sure, but it's still lacking. And then eating disorders affect men of every different background. I think when they were initially recognized in men, there was a stereotype that male wrestlers might develop an eating disorder, but we really see it. We can see it among male football players. It really doesn't matter.
Well, is it tough to hide? I mean, you'd think that it would become fairly apparent early on, but maybe not.
Yeah, eating disorders are actually often fairly easy to hide, especially in the beginning. Typically, they're pretty secretive illnesses, and there's often a lot of shame associated with the behaviors, and that typically motivates people to hide the behaviors. You know, the colder months allow people to hide changes in their weight under large baggy clothes. And oftentimes, you know, kids are away from home at school, and it's pretty easy to for their eating to go kind of unnoticed if there's changes in their eating.
Yeah, I can see how that could be. I'm trying to think about why or how people get involved in one of these and fall into one of these four or five that you were talking about. Are perfectionist personalities, are they more prone, for example, to eating disorders?
Yeah, we see that especially with anorexia and bulimia. For anorexia, we see a lot of perfectionistic, obsessive, and avoidant personalities. For bulimia, we see perfectionistic personalities as well as some impulsive temperament. Binge eating disorder is a more diverse population. There's not so much of a classic personality associated with that one. The RFID group is also pretty diverse, but there's a lot of anxious, avoidant, and obsessive personality in that group.
Yeah. I'm wondering about, I don't know, would you call it environmental situations that maybe an abusive relationship or some sort of transition in your life, maybe depression, any of those play a role?
Yeah, we usually think of eating disorders as developing out of the perfect storm. There's often some predisposing risk factors and then a trigger. So sometimes individuals with eating disorders have trauma. Trauma is a generalized risk factor for mental illness. So it's not necessarily something that we see in everyone with an eating disorder, but it is more common than in the general population. Depression and anxiety and a family history, that genetic component are all common.
They all play a role.
Risk factors, yeah.
We'll give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question, comment, or maybe an experience to share, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tracy in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance first. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You've touched on some of what I was calling about with regards to binge eating disorder, but it doesn't always equal becoming overweight or obese. My comment or question is about, you know, I work in mental health, and oftentimes when we see a person who is overweight or obese, we may remark that on what used to be considered access 3 on the medical side of things. But we don't often investigate into, you know, whether there's an eating disorder. It seems to me that it's overlooked, and not just in my practice, but in notes I see from others when I see a former client of theirs. So I guess I'm curious what's going on at Rogers with, you know, detecting and treating the opposite end of the spectrum of eating disorders that we tend to kind of, I think, overlook or forget about.
Interesting. Thanks, Tracy, for calling.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have seen a lot more people with binge eating disorder coming into treatment. There's been a lot more recognition of the illness really over the last 5 or 10 years, especially since it was added to the DSM-5 as its own discrete eating disorder entity. So we have seen a pretty significant uptick in patients with binge eating disorder seeking out treatment.
And have you had some success with treating and working with those folks?
Yeah, we have. Actually, we were just meeting as a group to discuss that, and they do typically have pretty good outcome measures. It is definitely a very treatable eating disorder. And those patients are pretty motivated usually to change the behaviors. Obviously, they're affecting their weight in a negative way, and so they are pretty motivated to get help.
Tracy, does that help out?
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Emmy in Presque Isle, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Emmy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, what can we do for you?
Well, I know this show is about disorders, but I have a family member, and it seems like anorexia that she has is related to perhaps effects of prescription medications she's taking, and a weird taste in her mouth, and also maybe some pancreatic or stomach issues, and just the differences between that type of anorexia and a disorder.
Hmm. Dr. Langford, comment?
We would typically not diagnose that as anorexia if it seems to be secondary to a medical condition. We would want the medical conditions to be addressed first. If that were to, you know, if somebody had some aversive feeling with eating, whether it's a weird taste in their mouth, whether it's, you know, if it's from medications or something else, then that would fit more with the avoidant restrictive food intake disorder category.
There we go. Thank you, Emmy, for calling. Joan in Stonebank, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Good morning, doctor. I currently have a granddaughter who is in the outpatient in that house, I don't know what you call it, in Delafield, and I have to pick her up tomorrow. She's going to be released and go to this outpatient in Oconomowoc for 3 more weeks, and then she's dismissed. She's 25 years old. She comes here and eats Saturday and Sunday now. I still think that she doesn't eat a very limited diet, very little. She's gained 12 pounds, which I'm proud of that. But she eats a lot of sweets, candy, and drinks like sweet teas and all this stuff. I can tell that she was lacking confidence. You people have built up her confidence, and she realizes that she was pretty sick. She has to stay in the hospital 3 or 4 days before you'd even take her. But I just fear that she's going to fall back into this trap when she goes to work and she's not being watched.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like she's made some great strides and sounds like she has some work to do. I think, you know, there is still a lot of support. It sounds like she was in the residential program and then transitioning to one of our partial hospitalization programs. So, you know, treatment happens in a stepwise progression, and hopefully people go through the whole entire continuum of treatment once and they're done. But sometimes people do, you know, have some areas where the eating disorder behaviors kind of sneak back in and they need to reenter treatment again. So I think it's important to recognize the gains that she's made and the work that she has to do, and also recognize the potential for there to be some regression when she does leave treatment and potential need for support again.
So how does do you keep tabs, Dr. Langford, or not you personally necessarily, but how do you arrange follow-up, or do you do that sort of follow-up after someone is released?
We definitely arrange follow-up. From the inpatient unit specifically, most patients will go to a pretty supported level of care, whether that's a residential program or a partial hospitalization program. And at a minimum, people will work with an outpatient team, and that would consist of a therapist, a dietitian, and a primary care doctor.
Mm-hmm. And let's go back. And Joan talked about the residential program. Could you explain how that whole process works? How would someone find herself in that sort, or himself in that sort of program? And what are the steps, and what are the programs about?
So the residential program is a program that has 24-hour staff supervision, so people will stay overnight there. It's a longer length of stay than an inpatient unit, and also people need to be medically stable, and typically it lasts for about 1 to 3 months. In that program, people really get intensive therapy. Most of the therapy is cognitive behavioral therapy with a strong component of exposure and response prevention. But they also get a lot of experiential therapy and do a lot of outings so that they can kind of practice their new skill set that, you know, is challenging their previous eating disorder behaviors in a variety of different settings.
Our guest today, Dr. Jody Langford, she is a board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist, medical director of the Child and Adolescent Eating Disorder Inpatient Program at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. Our guest today, I hope you'll join in with your own questions, experiences to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking about eating disorders today with Dr. Jody Langford, Medical Director of the Child and Adolescent Eating Disorder Inpatient Program at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for being with us today as we talk about this very important and serious problem that affects an estimated 30 million people at one time or another in their life. Dr. Langford, Ann called to say she believes her friend is bulimic and would like to know what she can do to help support her.
Well, I would really want to start with a pretty open conversation about your concerns and also sharing with the individual that there is help and that they're not alone in the struggle. There's plenty of resources to connect people to, as far as the Eating Disorder Hope Association, the National Eating Disorder Association. But really, I would really not be afraid to have an open conversation with someone that you're concerned is struggling.
And could this person also avail herself of that information at those sites that you were just talking about as help in having that conversation?
You mean, is there resources on how to have that conversation?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that the National Eating Disorder Association does have a helpline and a directory of resources that are available to help people.
Let's take another call. Justin in Appleton, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Well, I've been intermittent fasting now for about 4 months, skipping breakfast and lunch. And I just got to say, a couple of my friends and family they've gotten really concerned. They worried about me because I have lost weight, but that was just extra weight, and they were used to me. So my point is, I hope that there's not some people out there getting a little confused about fasting healthily and losing weight or having eating disorders.
Yeah, I think, I will say that engaging in a diet is a risk factor for developing an eating disorder, but there are plenty of people who do diet that don't develop an eating disorder. An eating disorder is really characterized by the really distorted thoughts that one has about their body and, you know, developing a low body weight. And the behavior is really kind of taking over their life and really having a negative impact on their life. The obesity medicine field has had some growing interest in intermittent fasting. I think it's really important, though, when anybody is taking on, you know, diets to really have on their radar that a risk factor of any diet is developing an eating disorder. That doesn't mean that it's absolutely going to happen, and that doesn't mean that dieting is an eating disorder. There's some gray there, mm-hmm. and there has to cross the threshold to when it becomes a problem.
Okay. Thanks, Justin. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Mike in Cleveland, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Two questions. Can adults develop the eating disorder? I believe Karen Carpenter, the musician, had issues with eating disorder in her 30s. And the other question I have is, do certain foods trigger certain reactions? A friend of mine who did have an eating disorder found out late in her 20s or 30s that she loved sushi, and that helped her to maintain her weight because there was no association with sushi from an earlier experience. And I don't know if certain foods help alleviate anxieties and this type of a reaction to food.
Good questions, Mike. Thanks for calling. Dr. Langford?
Yeah, you know, as far as the different foods, when we're starting treatment with somebody, we like to identify what are quote unquote safe foods. So those are foods that don't typically cause the individual huge amounts of anxiety, and we like to offer them those foods as frequently as we can. And then over time, with support of the treatment team, we like them to branch out and start to expose themselves to foods that are more challenging. So we don't really serve a lot of sushi in the hospital, but if sushi was a safe food, that would be something that, you know, we would encourage them to eat initially, but we definitely, you know, to reach recovery, we'd want them to be able to branch out and to be able to eat a variety of foods in a variety of different settings. As far as age of onset, adolescence is a common age of onset, but eating disorders can occur really at any stage in someone's life. We see them happening earlier now with younger adolescents, and then we also see them showing up in later life as well. So really, they can occur at any time in life.
At any time, okay. Ashley in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. I have a daughter who in high school gained some weight 1 year, and the pediatrician told her it was fine that year, but if it happened again the next year, that it would be a problem. And so she lost about 15 pounds and then an extra 15 pounds and has been very slim ever since then, and doesn't have dairy and won't eat meat now, and really is living off of vegetables and hummus. And I've talked to her about protein, and she's feeling she's getting enough protein from the hummus and broccoli, but I don't see her eating that much, and I'm just worried about her, and I don't know what to do because she's in college, she's getting good grades, she's holding down a job, and, you know, from the outside, it looks like she's got it all together, but I know what she's putting in, and it doesn't seem to be enough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a frequent trigger for, you know, people to be told by really well-meaning adults, whether it's a physician or a coach, that you know, that they maybe should lose some weight or need to watch out for further weight gain, that can pretty frequently trigger an eating disorder. With what you're saying, it sounds like your daughter is really following a pretty restricted pattern, and my guess has some, you know, maybe fears about branching out on her eating and fears about her weight changing. So I would be concerned as well, and I would definitely, you know, maybe encourage her to talk to a therapist and just get somebody else's opinion.
And if she's in college, there is support
yeah.
within universities and colleges for that sort of help, if I'm not mistaken. Dr. Langford,
university health programs are usually pretty knowledgeable about eating disorders because it is something that they see a lot on their campuses, for sure.
Thanks, Ashley. Appreciate it. Marie and Holman, your turn. Hi, Marie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm someone who has had a long history of eating disorders, starting with anorexia when I was 12, followed by 15 years of bulimia. And I'm in recovery now, and so my question is whether your guest would have recommendations for ongoing resources, perhaps online resources, for someone like myself who would appreciate continued support but does not have insurance that will continue to cover outpatient therapy.
Well, congratulations on achieving recovery. That's fantastic. You know, I know there are some online support groups, Eating Disorder Hope, National Eating Disorder Association, and the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders would be three websites that I would check out. There are some free apps, too, that can really be helpful for people who are working on eating disorder recovery. Recovery Road is one that allows you to track your meals, your feelings, and your long-term goals, and it does allow you to connect with others anonymously.
Recovery Road is the name of the app?
Yes.
Okay, and is it a free app or just
It small? Is a free app, I believe, yes.
Most of the apps anyway are pretty inexpensive for sure. And would you mind going back through those, the first three that you mentioned?
Sure. Eating Disorder Hope, National Eating Disorder Association, and the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders. That one's abbreviated as ANAD, A-N-A-D.
A-N-A-D. Marie, I hope that helps.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan in Milwaukee called to ask if Rogers Memorial recognizes the help that Overeaters Anonymous gives to people with eating disorders. Susan has been helped by that, by the organization.
So I am aware of Overeaters Anonymous. We don't have any collaboration with them, as far as I'm aware, but that's great that you've been helped by them.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to Dennis and Nina next. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
I have my mother. She's medically healthy, and she's just refusing to eat. She has no will to live anymore.
Oh, boy. Do you run into that, Dr. Langford?
I do not run into that in my practice with adolescents, but I am aware that, that does happen. That is something that's typically, I would really want pretty extensive medical workup for some medical etiology that might be reducing appetite, and also be concerned about, is there some depression that's leading to a decreased appetite?
So what would Dennis's next step be? Would it be to get his mother into...
Probably following up with the primary care provider.
Go back there and let the provider, sort of give the provider the background so that they can make recommendations or perhaps, send them to someone who could help out. I guess, Dennis, that's probably your next step. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Angie in Duluth, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Angie.
Hi. I have a daughter that's recently gone through treatment at the EMILY program in Minnesota. She suffers from anorexia. I'm just curious with the binge eating disorder, if they're finding that the group treatment, does it need to be separated out a little more? I know my daughter had a real hard time being in groups with patients that suffered from a disorder that was on the opposite end of the spectrum from them, where they're in groups and you've got some that are so averse to eating and are restricting so terribly, and then you've got others who can't wait for the next mealtime, which is a therapeutic meal. And it was really triggering for them and kind of a struggle. So I'm just curious if there's, been any research on that.
There's actually a lot of divide in the field about this. At Rogers, we do treat all of the eating disorders together. But we have had discussions amongst our colleagues as far as if this is the approach that is serving everyone. There are a couple of programs that do separate out the binge eating disorders. We want to make sure that everybody is getting the same treatment. The obviously the behaviors at the table are very different, but a lot of them do share some similar anxiety and fears of around their weight, even if even regardless of if they're restricting, or if the restricting is leading to binging.
So you try to, do you also then branch into individual treatments for some of those people?
Yeah. So at Rogers, we do really individualize the treatment. They have, one process group that is together, but everybody is working on their own individual exposures. So I think that helps allow people to be treated together in the same treatment program. An anorexic patient might have exposures related to resisting body checking or related to standing on a scale and looking at a feared number, whereas a individual with binge eating disorder might have exposures to sitting next to feared binge foods and resisting engaging in binging.
Yeah.
Angie, so they'll have very different programming.
Okay. Angie, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Cindy and Dousman will go to you next. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
And I had a cousin who, after high school, she got very thin, like 89 pounds. And, when I watched her eat, she'd eat like one strawberry and one spoon of tomato sauce or, kind of weird things. And she developed pancreatic cancer and died at 55. So I was wondering if the anorexia and the starving, of how it affects the body and the organs, and can it create cancer?
Good question. I'm not actually really aware of any increased risk of cancer, but we see eating disorders really affecting all organs, and obviously if people aren't in a good place nutritionally, their ability to fight off any illnesses is really impaired. But there isn't really any research connecting it with things like pancreatic cancer.
And, just online. By the way, you can join in, too, with your own questions or comments. We have open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. And just to Cindy talking about anorexia nervosa, it's the, as my understanding, it's the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric disorders. There's the patient's mental health and there's the physical health. What are the challenges for physicians when they try to find the best treatment course?
Yeah. Well, treatment availability is often a little bit of a challenge. We're pretty fortunate in southern Wisconsin because we have a variety of resources. But in rural areas, oftentimes even outpatient providers with knowledge in treating eating disorders can be a challenge. Sometimes insurance coverage can be a challenge as well, especially with atypical anorexia. This is when patients start out at a higher weight, lose a dramatic amount of weight, and really meet all of the psychological and medical aspects of the illness, but aren't at a low weight. And sometimes it's challenging to get them insurance coverage for the appropriate level of care for them. And someone's willingness to accept and enter treatment can also be a barrier and a challenge.
You do hear that self-acceptance and, love the skin you're in kind of thing. What do you think of the body positive movement? Does it work? Does it have a downside?
I think that it's great. I don't know that there's been any research showing that it decreases the prevalence of eating disorders, but it can be extremely helpful for individuals who are working on recovery from an eating disorder and who are working on accepting themselves. It can be a really positive message.
And you often hear that to be healthy, we should eat less, exercise more. I'm wondering if compulsive exercise can lead to eating disorders. Can exercise go overboard?
Yeah, absolutely. We see a lot of compulsive exercise in eating disorder patients, particularly with anorexia and bulimia. And it really can be a challenging aspect of their treatment. It's oftentimes something that's more difficult for individuals to wrap their mind around that it's a problem, because exercise is definitely typically a healthy thing, and it's hard for them to get that too much of a good thing can be harmful to them.
Yeah. Well, Christine in Appleton is up next with something for us. Hi, Christine. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just had a question regarding if anorexia and bulimia, could that just be a phase in someone's life? Like, I know someone in their 20s, they had all the symptoms of, they didn't eat, and when she did, she would take laxatives to get the food out of her, and she exercised in excess, and she was down to like 90 pounds. But now, as 20 years later, she doesn't have any of those issues. In fact, she's a little bit on the plump side, and I just was wondering, can anorexia be just a phase in one's life?
So some individuals can work through the illness without treatment, although usually that's not the case. We do hear of people though who will say that they had a history of anorexia and they didn't get treatment, but they no longer have the illness. It's also important to recognize, though, that there's a lot of migration amongst the eating disorders. So somebody can have anorexia for a while and maybe, increase their calorie intake and gain some weight, but then they might kind of fall into a pattern of binging and purging, or maybe, just engaging in some binging without purging. So there's a lot of migration among the eating disorders.
Gotcha. Thank you very much, Christine, for calling. Jim in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
And what's on your mind?
Well, I seem to have an insatiable attitude. My wife thinks it's overdone. I'm a working man, 69 years old, and I enjoy my food, but I'm always hungry. About every 2 hours, I need to eat.
Well, Dr. Langford, is that a circumstance that you've come across?
Well, I don't know if I would qualify that as an eating disorder unless someone's really distressed by their eating. So, if I would maybe encourage adding a little bit more fats to your meals to make them more satiating, but I don't know that I would qualify that as an eating disorder if you're not engaging in binging, when you're becoming really hungry.
So the metabolism runs a little hotter in Jim's case, is
yeah,
from the sound of it. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have we've talked about treatment paths a little bit. When do you recommend inpatient treatment programs versus outpatient programs?
Yeah, I think typically we think of outpatient treatment for somebody who's, in the eating disorder was recognized fairly early. They're pretty open to treatment. They're motivated to recover, and they have pretty good psychosocial support. We consider hospitalization for individuals with medical instability or who have severely low body weight if they're engaging in extreme behaviors such as extreme calorie restriction, acute food refusal, they're purging multiple times a day, or if there's severe psychiatric comorbidity, especially if somebody's struggling with suicidal thinking or self-injurious behaviors.
We have, we're starting to run out of time here, but just I wonder if you have any thoughts on the influence of media in all this, the images of incredibly thin people on Instagram feeds, you see it in magazines or TV or store models for that matter. Do you think eating disorders are influenced by societal pressures?
Yeah, there's actually been quite a bit of research on this, that societal factors, including the thin ideal, is a well-established risk factor for eating disorders. Eating disorders are much more common in developed countries. And there was a pretty well-known study called the Fiji Study, where Harvard researchers examined the influence of introduction of TV on a province of Fiji and 3 years after the eating disorder thinking and dieting attitudes were really increased dramatically.
I want to go back just in conclusion here and to some of the resources. You mentioned quite a few, but it'd be worth it just to repeat some of those sources where people can go for more information or perhaps for more help.
Yeah, so Eating Disorder Hope, National Eating Disorder Association, and ANAD, the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders.
Well, Dr. Langford, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I hope we have a chance to do this again. I appreciate very much you spending your time with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dr. Jody Langford, a board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist. She's a medical director of the Child and Adolescent Eating Disorder Inpatient Program at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, and they do a lot of very good work there at Rogers Memorial. And it was great to have her with us. Well, we're going to switch gears entirely coming up next. One of the people I enjoy talking to every couple of months, Mike Bino, is coming back next to talk with us about Our Wisconsin magazine and what's going on here in the state. Stay with us.